Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm still talking about Kato, Shobogenzo, True Dharma Eye, Kato, Twining Vines. So we're still talking about the first paragraph. Last time I talked about Shakyamuni Buddha and Mahakashapa, and this week I want to talk about Bodhidharma. Here's the first paragraph that we're discussing. The experience and transmission in the order on Vulture Peak of Shakyamuni Buddha's right Dharma eye treasury, and the supreme truth of Bodhi belongs only to great master Mahakashapa. Authentically experienced in the transmission from the rightful successor to rightful successor, it arrives at the 28th patriarch, Venerable Bodhidharma. The Venerable One demonstrates in China the behavior of an ancestor and transmits the right Dharma eye treasury and the supreme truth of Bodhi to the great master Taisho Eka, making him the second ancestor. So today we're going to talk about Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma is the 28th ancestor after Shakyamuni. He is the first ancestor in China. So there are many important people in the lineage in those 28 Dharma successions between Mahakashapa and Bodhidharma, but for the most part, in Zen, we don't talk about them very much, probably because they were not Zen masters in the school of Zen. Some of them we know, usually Ananda. Most people know who Ananda is. Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu are in our lineage. On Thursday morning, we chant the lineage. So in Chan school, we claim allegiance to and recognition from this lineage going from Shakyamuni Buddha and the seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni down in the lineage chants down through all the way down to our particular temple. So at a certain point, the lineage is split off and they start to be temple lineages. So for us, our teacher is Mel Weitzman. His teacher was Suzuki Roshi. So our lineage ends at Suzuki Roshi when we chant the lineage. Okay, so Bodhidharma's teacher was Prajnatara. And there's an interesting story about Prajnatara that I thought I'd share with you. Immediately after Prajnatara recognized Bodhidharma as his heir, he essentially self-combusted. So I'll read the part here of what happened to what he did. So here, this is from a text called Records of the Transmission of the Lamp, which is a 11th century text with transmission stories of all of the various ancestors. So in this text it says, having transmitted the Dharma, the master rose from his seat and stretching out his hands at each side, 27 bright rays of dazzling multicolored light streamed out from each hand. Then he sprung himself into the air to the height of 7 palm trees and transformed into fire. I mean, this is like, right? And then from heaven, the Sharira relics came down like rain. Sharira are these little kind of jewel-like rock sort of things that are found after someone who's very holy is cremated. So people go through the ashes and they find these little relics, and they look like little stones. So the Shariras from him, his sort of self-emulation or whatever was going on there, start raining down from the sky. They collected them, and a temple was built to house them. So that's what happened to Bodhidharma's teacher, Prajnatara. But before Prajnatara did this, he told Bodhidharma that he had to wait 68 years after his death, not Bodhidharma's, but Prajnatara's death. He had to wait 68 years before he went to China to transmit the Dharma, because this happened in India. So in those 68 years, Bodhidharma did a lot of teaching. But what we're most interested in our school is what happened when he got to China. So Dogen, in Gyoji, continuous practice, the fascicle from Shobogenzo, I think has this very evocative paragraph about Bodhidharma going from India to China, which I'll read to you. And I think I've read this before, but I just love this. So Dogen writes, "For 3 years of frosts and springs during that ocean voyage, how could the wind and snow have been the only miseries? Through how many formations of clouds and sea mist might the steep waves have surged? He was going to an unknown country. Ordinary beings who value their body and life could never conceive of such a journey. This must have been maintenance of the practice realized solely from the great benevolent vow of Bodhidharma to transmit the Dharma and save deluded beings. It was so because the transmission of Dharma is Bodhidharma himself. It was so because the transmission of Dharma is the entire universe. It was so because the whole universe in 10 directions is the real state of truth. Because the saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself, he was without alarm and doubt, and he was not afraid. Because saving deluded beings is the entire universe, he was not alarmed and doubting, and he was without fear. Thus, he left his father's kingdom forever, made ready a great ship, crossed the southern seas." So that's Dogen's story about his paragraph about Bodhidharma, the trials, difficulties of this 3-year ocean voyage from India to China. Dogen himself went to China. He went there in 1223, so he was 23 years old, and he returned in 1227, having received Dharma transmission from Tendo Nyojo in the Soto school. He brought it back to Japan, and he had to cross the China Sea, which I understand is quite a rough passage. So I suspect that when he writes about Bodhidharma and not being frightened, and he writes about the mists and the waves and the storms, he's writing about his own experience of going to China. So essentially, this story that Dogen tells is about our spiritual journey. It's a story about how we commit ourselves to, how we make this journey in our lives, in our spiritual lives. We encounter hardships along the path, and yet we just continue to practice in the midst of our hardships. We are in an unknown country, because how can we know what our life will bring us, what our practice will bring us? So we're being asked to fully immerse ourselves in this practice. We're being asked to fully engage in this practice, even though we don't know what will happen. And of course, this is true of our life in general. We don't know what's going to happen in our life. So we have to, in a certain way, give up knowing. And giving up this knowing can be scary. It can be very frightening when we don't know what's going to happen. So we cling to the desire to know. And there's a way in which this clinging soothes us in a way. This journey, this engagement, is a process of maturation. It's not an annihilation of undesirable traits. Okay? The journey that we engage in our spiritual practice is not about ruthlessly getting rid of some aspect of ourselves that we have labeled as being undesirable. It is a way that we are fully engaged in the waves, fully engaged in the mist, fully engaged in this process, of transformation, and that's part of what Kato is about. Kato means twining vines. Our life is twining vines. Our life is this intimacy of the twining of vines together, of the vines of our relationships, the vines of the totality of the whole world functioning, and the vines of how we respond to our problems. Because another definition of Kato is also about problems, right? So how do we respond to our problems? And that's, I think, a big part of practice is about how do we respond? What is it that we're trying to do? So we do have an image of what we're about, but this image should not be carried out in a kind of harsh, punitive way towards ourselves or others. For Bodhidharma, because he was pretty far advanced in his practice by the time he went to China, his understanding was deep. He carried into this unknowing, this unknowable, this vow to benefit all beings. That seems to be what motivated Bodhidharma to go to China. It says, my vow to save deluded beings. So he wanted to do this activity through enacting the Buddha way, teaching the Buddha way to people in China. He was a missionary, right? Bringing this particular understanding of Buddhism to China. He sustained himself with this vision of what it was that he was about. He sustained himself with this vow of what it was that he was engaged in. So I want to talk about that today. I want to talk about vow and what it is and how it sustains us. Suzuki Roshi referred to how we articulate to ourselves what it is that we're doing. He called it our inmost request. Inmost request. So this going into our heart, you know, and looking into our hearts and saying, what is my deepest request? What is it that... And I really... Inmost request is... It's this mind and heart looking in, but it's also our Buddha nature coming forth. So it's the inmost request of our Buddha nature, our true nature, this nature that is our inalienable essence as beings in this world, in coordination, conjunction, and interpenetration with the totality of the whole world. That's that true self. Like, how do we enact that in the particularity of our life? Not some kind of like idea about it. So that's the other side of it, is that inmost request, like looking inward and saying, what is this request? Like, how do I actually articulate that? So in Bodhidharma's case, he articulated it to himself by saying, saving all beings. And so that reflects his intention to teach and to bring the Dharma to others. For us, I would say that our actions are directed towards embodying qualities of realization, but that in itself is still not specific enough. But this vow that we have, like, we can misinterpret Bodhidharma's vow to mean he is going to save all beings. And so this is not about us going out and proselytizing or going out and telling other people how to live their lives. That's not what the vow is about. So for us, the vow has to be not the vow to change others, but to look at our own behavior and to embody the Dharma, right? To embody and engage the Dharma and be living the Dharma in our own lives, not worried about getting other people to do something different than what they're doing. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were talking about giving a lecture. They were saying, well, I'm going to give this lecture, and I'm going to tell the people to whom I'm lecturing how they need to work on being more joyful. So that's not, and I did tell this person this, that's not what we're about, right? If we are joyful ourselves, truly joyful and not in a Pollyannish way, then that's really, we're embodying that practice of joy. It's either rub off or it's not. But we don't need to go around telling other people that they're not joyful. So you know, that's, just wanted to get that in here to make sure that everybody was clear about what we are doing or not doing in this particular activity of figuring out what our vow might or might not be. So our mission, if you will, is to transform our own unskillful behavior and to save others through embodying what is good and beneficial in the Dharma through our own behavior. So in this way, our vow to practice is less global and becomes more personal. We want a vow that actually reflects our own personal desire, our own personal inmost request. So in order to do that, the vow has to be specific. And you know, the vow could change. Like, it might be, I don't think it's going to change. If it's a really deep vow, it's not going to change week to week. But over the course of your practice, you know, it might be that that vow is going to shift and change because hopefully we've enacted some transformation. So in that way, maybe the thing we were most concerned about initially when we formulated this notion may have actually resolved itself. And so we come up with something else that's more germane to our lives in this moment. So again, to say saving all beings is just too lofty an idea for us to kind of get a handle on. The other thing about kind of lofty ideals like this is they give us an out. They kind of like give us a way to kind of get real slippery about enacting this. Like, I'm going to save all beings? What's that about? That means that I must go and do something that's so absolutely amazing and incredible. Like, I have to go to another country. Like, go to Mozambique right now, and I've got to, like, you know. But my life doesn't actually allow me to do that. So if I can't do that, then I don't have to worry about it anymore because I can't do that. So I can't save all beings. Therefore, I'm just not going to worry about it. Like, I can just keep going and being rude at the grocery store because I... Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, we kind of engage in this sort of screwy logic. So if our vow is very specific and it actually pertains to our life as it is right now, right here, then it's a lot harder to kind of slide around in that. So we have this deep desire for personal transformation that we're defining to ourselves within the context of Buddhist practice, because this is a Buddhist temple and we're talking about Buddhism. So we do it within the context of our Buddhist practice. We say, you know, do I want to cultivate kindness? Do I need to cultivate kindness? Do I need to practice patience, which is the antidote to anger? Do I need to work with generosity because I'm kind of greedy? You know, what is it that trips me up, you know, in my relationships that gets in the way of maybe that my deepest desire is to communicate with people. Maybe my deepest desire is to feel loved or connection. Maybe I don't know, you know, what your deepest desire is, but the thing in a way, maybe that is painful, you know. That desire comes out of that. Yeah, out of that feeling of like not somehow, it's not quite there. Or maybe the desire comes from you notice that you're just really impatient. You know, I have a bad habit of interrupting people. So, you know, my deepest vow is deeper than not wanting to interrupt people, but the enactment of it includes not interrupting. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's like this way in which it's very specific in that way. Okay, I'm going to walk out the door today and really do my best to not interrupt someone. Or maybe what goes along with that is something that's seemingly trivial, like I'm going to use my blinker when I'm driving my car. When I'm turning, I'm going to actually turn on the blinker. because I realized that other people around me might like to know what I'm doing with this, what, 5-ton piece of metal that's moving around in the world. So this way in which we identify this kind of deep desire, which comes from some sense of things aren't working in a certain way, and then we identify what specifically it is that we can work on in this. So what will you do? What do you need to work on? What is the source of your suffering or your unskillfulness? So this vow is an antidote to a particular difficulty, if you will. So we begin with a vow that sustains us where we are. So in the vow also has to be something that's encouraging to ourselves. So there's a way in which I think we can be addicted to behaviors that are not particularly helpful. And often we are felled by them. It's kind of like an addiction. It's like we realize that we're really deeply suffering because of this thing, whatever it is. So early on in my practice, I really had to struggle with anger a lot. And I got a lot of really unskillful feedback. The universe likes to give us feedback. Inevitably, we will receive feedback. And often, maybe more often than I would like, it's not particularly skillful. So I was getting a lot of unskillful feedback about my anger. So at some point, I just felt like somebody who was completely knocked down by this, just on the ground with my tongue hanging out, going, "Uncle, okay, I'll change, you know, because I can't do this anymore." So the inmost request on a certain level comes from, "Oh, geez, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I'm suffering, I'm really suffering." And the other side is, "Yes, yes, I want to integrate. I want to integrate." And this anger in particular is an emotion that tends to push away, right? That's the defense mechanism of anger, is to push away. Greed is more like, if I can get more, I will be happy somehow that way. But my greed actually causes me suffering, because I realize in this desire to get more, get more, get more, I'm not able to actually integrate myself with what's actually happening. And then the third one, delusion, we used to say greed, hate, and delusion. Delusion is more, the way I think of it is, that place where we go where we just can't relate at that point, right? Like we turn away and act as if it doesn't exist. That's also a source of suffering. So this way that we can use the teaching to kind of define to ourselves the nature of our experience, define to ourselves what it is or it isn't, you know, and say, well, if I see that my pattern is that I'm constantly turning away, maybe I need to figure out a way to turn towards. If my pattern is that I'm constantly greedy in the situation that's causing me so much suffering, maybe I need to stop thinking about not clinging or whatever, or maybe the antidote to that is a kind of generosity. If my response is anger or whatever, there's kind of pushing away emotions, maybe I need to like start looking at that and opening that up. So in this way, this vow becomes a very specific thing. But the vow itself needs to be a positive affirmation to ourself. Okay? It can't be a thing where we say, "I am a bad person, therefore I must do this thing." Because if we do that, we don't want to do it. Who wants to do that? That's another more of that feedback from the universe that's like not skillful. Right? So we don't want to be the engine of unskillful feedback to ourselves. We want to come up with a vow that is positive. So that's kind of part of the homework, if you want to do this, is to say, how do I do this in a way that's positive, you know, that encourages me to do this practice? That's one of the nice things about these stories, right? So you might read this story and not say to yourself, "Oh, this is an interesting way to look at what Bodhidharma was up to." But that's one of the reasons we love these stories about people, right? We read stories about Mother Teresa. Or we read a story about the Dalai Lama. You know, he says, my religion is compassion. That resonates for us, right? We say, oh, wow, that's cool. I want my religion to be compassion too, you know? And so then when you do something that's not compassionate, you might remember the Dalai Lama saying, my religion is compassion, and say, oh yeah, I want to be like him. You know, so how do we create these vows for ourselves that are positive, that encourage us and remind us what when we're suffering, and remind us when we engage in something that's not skillful, we say, oh yeah, that's really not what I want to be doing. I want to remember my inmost request. I want to remember my vow. That is not really what I want to engage in. So this vow should sustain us where we are in our lives. Again, it's not something to let our mind slide away from our responsibilities because we've made the vow too global and too broad. So what is it you can do right here, right now? What is it you can do while you're driving your car? What is it you can do when you're at the grocery store? What is it you can do while you're talking to your partner or your friends? How is it that we relate to strangers? You know, what is it that we're doing that is basically an awareness that we're not the only guy in the world? You know, basically an awareness that we share the totality of our experience with the whole world. So maybe we don't dart out between cars while we're jaywalking and give some poor driver a heart attack. So there's this way that it's a kind of, it is a kind of generosity and acknowledgement. And then, of course, there are other things that are much harder because those are the situations where we're getting a lot of feedback, you know? The situations that are really hard where we want to respond defensively. Or we want to hide, or we want to, I don't know, whatever it is, instead of just standing there in the midst of it and doing our best, remember our vow, you know. My deepest vow is, I'm going to listen, you know, I'm going to listen. Another part of you goes, I don't want to listen. Okay, we're going to listen, you know, this way that we do this. I can tell you, you know, it's like going. I remember going back to my cabin, being so mad at somebody. Is it Tassajara? You know, I have these little. I felt like Gollum or something in the Lord of the Rings. It's like, I don't want to do this. No, you must do it. No, I don't want to do this. It's their fault. No, it's not. You know, back and forth with myself about this. Do you remember you have an inmost request? I don't care about an inmost request. I want my way, you know. So, you know, you just keep coming back and coming back and coming back. And the image that I came up with for that with myself is I felt like this puny little person in a rowboat trying to move the Queen Mary. Can you imagine like a tug, you know, the tugboats are moving, but you're not a tugboat. You're like, there's my vow, you know, but I'm rowing, you know. So sometimes it feels like that, you know, practice just feels like that. I'm exhausted talking about it. So we have to be willing to go through that, and that's that journey, that's that, you know, crossing the ocean, that's going from India to China, taking 3 years, and the mist and the clouds and the waves. And the saying, you know, Dogen said, maybe that was not the only doubt. I love that part, you know. It's like, oh, Bodhidharma might have been, you know, he was a human being. He was a human being who was doing this really difficult thing. And he was being sustained by his vow, but at the same time, you know, it was not the only doubt. So I like that, that little sentence in there. I ran across this online, this thing that Robert Aiken did around the Bodhisattva vows. So we all know the Bodhisattva vows, right? Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to enter them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to... delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. So he talks about those. It's a article in Tricycle in 1992. And what they did is they had this class, and I don't know if you were there, they had this class and they went back and they translated from the Japanese again these Bodhisattva vows. So beings are numberless. They translated the second part as the I vow to save them as enabling them to cross over. So you know the story in Buddhism about the raft crossing over the river. And then, so you use the teachings of the Buddha and the structure of Buddhism to cross the river, and then you can get off the raft, you leave the raft at the river, right? For most of us, we're still on the river with the raft. So.
It's sinking.
No, Doug. We're still rowing that rowboat. Without, it doesn't have a hole in the bottom of it. So I vow to enable them to cross over. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. So what the way they translated it as these delusions and this ending them is I vow to end what distresses the mind. I really like that. I vow to end what distresses the mind. Our minds, right? This inmost request, this vow. What distresses my mind? How can I use Buddha's teachings to actually transform, come up with the antidote to that distress? Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. And what they translated it, the entering, as to be receptive to them, right? So these Dharma gates are every moment of our life. Every interaction and experience is a Dharma gate. This way that we can enter into practice. It doesn't have to feel like some kind of endless trudging. What was it what's her face, the poet who says, you know, you don't have to crawl on your hands and knees across the desert, Mary Oliver. This is not about crawling across the desert on your hands and knees. We can't practice that way. We can't practice that way. So this way in which we say, how can I be receptive to this, I think, very inspiring teaching? To look at every moment, because if we look at every moment of our life as a Dharma gate, it also means that every time we fall down, there's still a Dharma gate, right? It doesn't mean you messed up, bang, the gates are shut. That's not what it means, but that's kind of a way we think about it. Oh, I messed up. I didn't enter this Dharma gate. Well, yeah, you did. It's like they're... I don't know how to describe it. Dharma gates are not, in a way, they're not things you go through. Dharma gates are thing itself. So there's this way, the Mumon Khan, the gateless gate, it is life itself, always presencing itself for you, with you, as you, in conjunction with all being. Those are the Dharma gates, being receptive to this life. Falls down, gets up. Falls down, gets up. The Japanese say, fall down 7 times, gets up 8. Right? Bodhidharma doll. You know, so here's Bodhidharma. Dharuma dolls, we've all seen them. They're these little dolls with the rounded bottoms. And you paint in the eyes. And you can't knock them over. So they're, you know, they... So the first section of the Bodhisattva vows... are kind of like beings are numberless, delusions are inexhaustible, Dharma gates are boundless, Buddhist ways unsurpassable. They're like a lifelong koan. They are our lifetime practice. They are saying, settle into this practice. Settle into your life. Practice is not separate from your life. Settle into your life. The second part of the vow is the path of how we enact the vow, which is actually something I had not seen in these Bodhisattva vows before. They are the path of our enactment. So the first one, I vow to benefit all beings, is another way to talk about I vow to save them, because saving has a kind of Christian connotation for us. I vow to benefit all beings. This is this initial awakening of the bodhicitta mind. This is this initial awakening to the practice. I want to make things better. I want to benefit myself and others. How do we do that within the capacity of ourself, our personalities, and our situation? Because that must always be taken into account. How do I do that in the context of my life as it is right now, and yet not let myself off the hook? To do this in a way that's compassionate towards self and other. We acknowledge that moment to moment we may be caught in our problems. And this is the second one, which is what distresses the mind, right? That we may be caught in our problems, we're caught in misunderstandings, we're caught in unwholesome actions and desires. So that we are caught in this, because this is what it is to be a human being, right? No one escapes this. It's like we say, well, you know, you don't get out of this, what is it, you don't get out of this life alive? No one escapes problems, distresses, all of these things that come to us. So this is the second one, what distresses the mind. So we acknowledge that and use our practice to work with that. And then we recognize that there's work to be done in this realm. We know and we have faith that we can make this transformation within the self. So that's part of this. We have faith. This is Bodhidharma's faith in the text. He says, I have faith in my vow. I have faith in this practice. I have faith in my life. I have faith in the universe. My place in that universe, the universe's place within the context of the totality of all being. And that is essentially wholesome. And so he says, you know, so this is this way in which this transformation of the self is about entering each Dharma gate, benefiting others, benefiting ourselves, seeing our life as a journey, an inquiry in which we are receptive to our life, we're receptive to what comes our way, and that we become resilient and know that we're going to get knocked down, and at the same time that we can get up. Know that we have Sangha. We say, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. That we can get up. We can support each other. We can look to the teachings. We can look to each other. We can practice with each other. Not just practice like do the practice, but practice like make mistakes and practice entering Dharma gates with each other. So this opportunity to practice realization. And the fourth one is that we recognize that this particular path is our path. So this is the part that's, you know, about Buddhism. This is our path. This is our tribe, right, if you will. By taking this path, we pledge not to run away when it gets hard. That's one of the things, you know, people sometimes make up their own religious practices, which is fine. But often what we do when we do that is that we don't take up the hard parts of that particular practice. We only do the part of the practice that kind of inspires us, which is great to do that. But one of the things about practicing in a tradition where you do the whole practice is sometimes it's hard. You know, sometimes it's like you're really getting pressed on. And so it's hard to stay in the middle of that. You know, one of the things about sitting Zazen is that when we come together and sit Zazen is when you're here, you're here. You don't get up usually and leave in the middle of Zazen. You stay. When you're at home, it's like, oh my God, did you leave the stove on? Oh, I've got to get water for the dog. Oh my God, I have to put the laundry in. So it's like we're just, you know, we sit down, we're there for 10 or 15 minutes, maybe not quite that long, and all of a sudden we remember something that absolutely must be done. So there's this way in which this structure supports us in the midst of how we're doing this when it gets hard. you know, that we can do this together. So we recognize and take on that this is our tribe, these are our ancestors, this is our family, this is our Sangha. We look out for other examples. And then we recognize, so I'm still talking about number four here, about Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. We recognize that each person and being is Buddha, because that's part of our teaching. Maybe, you know, we're talking about cold Buddha, hot Buddha. Maybe messed up Buddha. You know, maybe Buddha who annoys the hell out of me, Buddha. You know, Buddha who I love to death. Buddha who could do no wrong. So there's this way that that's a koan, you know. How do I look at somebody who so embodies for me political beliefs and things that I think are important, humanitarian things, and how do I look at them and say that person is Buddha in a way that isn't all weird, you know, but is real? How do I do that? So that's a good koan. And maybe the way that gets enacted is I just respect that person for who they are, even though I don't agree with them. So it means that when we can do that in a real concrete way is we can have a dialogue that is respectful, not necessarily polarizing, and that we can actually have an interaction with goodwill, even though we don't agree with that person. Because that's the only way that we can actually enter that Dharma gate, right, with that person. So we recognize that each person and being is Buddha as we integrate with the Buddha nature of the world itself, right? With the world itself as it is in this moment of my life. So our vows and the more global, our vows and the more global bodhisattva vows are grounded and informed by the knowledge that what is transmitted and where our wisdom is seated is on the throne of this life. Okay? That we know that what is transmitted and where our wisdom is seated is right now in this moment. Where you are right now. And that this person is this person and not this person. I am a particular person and I am not this person. You are a particular person and you are not that person. And what this means is that we are particular and yet simultaneously we are universal with each other, interconnected, interpenetrating with the totality of our lives and everything, not just other people, but everything in our lives. So we are part of a whole, and or we are the whole, and we are at the same time this person. So this vow, right, for this person. But how that vow is enacted has to do with the totality of not this person. So Dogen's saying that this is the last part of this phrase here where Dogen talks about, he says, it was so because the transmission of Dharma is Bodhidharma himself. It was so because the transmission of Dharma is the entire universe. It was so because the whole universe in the 10 directions is the real state of truth. So he's saying that this universe in the 10 directions and Bodhidharma and transmitting the Dharma are happening continuously, which means that we too are continuously engaged in this activity. We are not different than Bodhidharma. We are not different than the 10 directions. We embody this vow. From a Buddhist perspective, even if you're not articulating the vow to yourself, you're still embodying it. But in order to enact it, we have to articulate it to ourselves. We have to have some clarity about what we're up to. So Bodhidharma knew this, and he knew how to enact this truth through his own body. Because he had such clarity about this truth and his own life in the Dharma and as the Dharma, he was not afraid. He was not afraid. And in this way, he went to this unknown place. So this metaphor for this unknowability of life. We don't know what's going to happen. In some ways, we rely upon the myth that we tell ourselves that things will stay the same. And I think we need that. We need, you know, we go to work every morning, we want to know the building's in the same place. We go to work every morning, you know, we want to know our car's out in the driveway. So there's this way we want to depend upon our lives being stable, and I think that's really important. It's kind of like the difference between universal non-dual time and sequential time. You have to get to work on time, you look at your watch, you say, you know, okay, I'm going to get to work on time. And yet, simultaneously, there's always the unknowability of it. This, we can't live in that world, I think, because we'd be totally freaked out all the time. And yet, simultaneously, that is the reality of our world, is that your car may not be in the driveway, that building may not be there. So what comes from that is not fear, but a way of which we cultivate gratitude. So this deep faith that Bodhidharma had, at the same time, he was aware of the fact that things are impermanent, that we die, that we get sick, that things change. So he was unafraid in the midst of that. And yet, I think he also, as Dogen hints at here, he also, as a human being, had that fear that we all have. That balancing, right? I mean, we are. I think we're balancing this way of recognizing our impermanence and at the same time living that out in a wholesome way, and also acknowledging the fact that that can be really scary. That can be a really scary thing. Suzuki Roshi supposedly said, "I am afraid to die." That's a wonderfully liberating statement for all of us, which is why we remember it. Suzuki Roshi, who we say, oh, you know, the Dharma master in this lineage for us, most contemporary, you know, Suzuki Roshi. And yet, Suzuki Roshi said, I'm afraid to die. And he died. Right? He died. My teacher said, who is 90-something now, he said, he said, 90, 89? Almost 90, he said, you know, my job now is to teach people how to die. Which also, I mean, to my mind, means to also teach himself about that as well. As he really enters into his life and stands in the midst of, as we get older, of course, impermanence becomes more and more real to us as far as our own bodies are concerned. So we stand in the midst of that impermanence. You know, I am afraid, I am here. This Dharma gate, I am here, and I am afraid, and I am joyful, and I am grateful, and I'm afraid, I'm confused, all those things that go through our minds at each moment that we stay in the middle of this. Okay, so I'm going to read the paragraph to you again. That will be the end of the lecture. For 3 years of frosts and springs during that ocean voyage, how could the wind and snow have been the only miseries? Through how many formations of clouds and sea mist might the steep waves have surged? He was going to an unknown country. Ordinary beings who value their body and life could never have conceived of such a journey. This must have been maintenance of the practice realized solely from the great benevolent will of Bodhidharma to transmit the Dharma and save deluded beings. It was so because the transmission of Dharma is Bodhidharma himself. It was so because the transmission of Dharma is the entire universe. It was so because the whole universe in the 10 directions is the real state of truth. Because the saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself, he was without alarm and doubt, and he was not afraid. Because saving deluded beings is the entire universe, he was not alarmed and doubting, and he was without fear. Thus he left his father's kingdom forever and made ready a great ship and crossed the southern sea. Thank you.